Just to set this up, Job, you'll recall, has endured Satan's attacks, both in terms of his possessions and most recently in his body. Having lost all of his servants, his livestock, and his children, and soon thereafter to be inflicted with boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, Job's wife, no doubt reeling from all of these things herself, said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, exactly what she meant by that has been the subject of much debate, but I tend to believe that her words were more an expression of love for her husband than anything intentionally sinister, as is the case, or should be the case, with any loving wife. She simply hated seeing her husband suffer. So we need to give her the benefit of the doubt. We've never suffered in quite this way, and heaven forbid that we would suffer in this way, but we need to understand that Job's wife's comments may have been rooted in her love for him. We don't have to automatically go to the dark side and attribute to her any motives that we're not sure those are actually her motives. Anyway, motives aside, Job gently chastised her, saying, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" As I pointed out last week, by God's grace, Job had a firm understanding of how God causes all things to work together for good to those who are loved by Him and called according to His purpose. This is evident, I believe, in the author's statement at the end of verse 10. In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Of course, there's a great deal more that we can learn from this, which is why I would encourage you, if you haven't been with us over the last few weeks, go to Sermon Audio and give the last few messages a listen as the Lord allows, and then that'll fill you in on everything that we've covered up to this point. Well, this brings us to verse 11, and here we read this. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. Now, let's just stop here for a minute because it's important to note that these three men were not just among Job's neighborhood pals. A man of Job's stature, a man of Job's wealth, a man of Job's great influence would have had friends far and wide, which is why we're told where these three men were from. Now, just as an aside, in the Septuagint, these men are actually referred to as kings. Interestingly, the word translated in the Septuagint as kings can also be translated as chiefs, chieftains, or heads of local tribes. Nevertheless, these are men who are important in their own right. These are men who, wherever they are from, exercise some form of authority, much in the same way that a chief of a tribe or a clan would enjoy authority. So, who are they in particular? Well, first we have Eliphaz the Temanite. According to Genesis 36:10, Eliphaz was Esau's son. Eliphaz was Esau's son. Eliphaz's son was named Teman. So why is Eliphaz said to be a Temanite? Well, this is because the city in which they had settled in that particular region of Edom was named not after Eliphaz, but after his son, who according to Genesis 36:15 was the first chief among Eliphaz's sons. The inhabitants of the city of Teman seem to have been quite famous for their great wisdom. And so this was a fairly prominent place during Job's day. And here we have actually the city that's named after Esau's grandson. And we have Eliphaz, who is Esau's son, who is also a friend of Job. That helps not only to realize how important Job was, it also helps us put this in a chronological context. When was it that Job lived? Well, it was obviously during the time of Esau's sons. Okay. So next we have Bildad the Shuhite. And what is a shoe height, you ask? Well, according to the Bible, a shoe height has nothing to do with his height. Even though I joke about it all the time, Bildad was the shortest man who ever lived because he was only a shoe height. That's not at all biblical. That's just my attempt at humor. But a shoe height was a descendant of Shua. Shua was the son of Abraham with his second wife, Keturah. Keturah, at one time, you'll recall, was actually one of Abraham's concubines. When Sarah died, he took Keturah to be his wife, and they had other children together. Among them was Shua. Shua's people also settled in the land of Edom. It's really hard to nail down exactly where they were because of their nomadic status. They were among the tribes that traveled hither and yon across that part of the world, seeking water for their flocks, grazing for their flocks. They were never in one place too long. So Shua's people are fairly hard to nail down at any one point. Now, what's interesting is that according to the Septuagint, Bildad is referred to as Bildad, the sovereign of the Sakeans. This comes from one of the smaller villages in the region that was also inhabited by the descendants of Shua called Sakea. Sakea, it's not a place that we have an exact location for today, again, because the people there were very fond of moving from place to place, and it might have just been a temporary city or village. Well, finally, we have Zophar, the Namathite. As his name suggests, Zophar was an inhabitant of Nama. And where was this city located? Most scholars are in agreement that it was in the southern part of Edom, although we really don't know exactly where it was. Zophar, like the other two friends of Job, was also a very important man. In fact, the Septuagint identifies him as Zophar, king of the Menaeans. And who were the Menaeans? Well, it's believed that Nama is another name for a place called Maon, from which the Menaeans got their name. Again, all this is cloaked in significant mystery because we just don't know where these places are today. Archaeology is making discoveries every day that uncover certain portions of the Bible that were previously determined or thought to be mythological. And it's amazing, not surprising, but it's amazing how these advances in archaeology and anthropology, they've been able to actually corroborate much of what the Bible says. Will they ever find these villages? Maybe, maybe not. If you know anything about that area, it is a vast wilderness, and it's not very easy to preserve ruins in that area. I mean, they find ruins in that area sometimes 10, 20, 30 feet below the surface of the ground. So, and if you don't know where you're looking to begin with, it can be very difficult to find where these places are. Suffice it to say, though, these are not near neighbors of Job, but they're close enough to him so that they could have convened together and said, "Our friend Job is in trouble. Let's go down and comfort him." Again, we need to understand that they were men of stature, as Job was himself. And we need to understand that because contrary to a popular caricature, you know, a lot of times you read about Job's three friends and you would think you're reading about the Three Stooges. Right? I mean, some of the disparaging words that people have for Job's friends, all because of some of the things they're going to say to him, some of the cracks in their own understanding, and so on and so forth. Don't be so quick to write them off as not knowing what's going on. These were very influential men. These were, by all accounts, very wise men. Did they understand fully the things of God? No. We've talked about that before. The aperture in terms of the revelation of God is opening very slowly. And so they didn't have much at all by way of direct revelation. And so everything that they really understand about God, Job himself, they have received from the Holy Spirit. They have received from God himself in various ways. Well, anyway, they made up their mind. They're going to go and see him. And when they heard that he was suffering so, they made an appointment together, we're told, and they come to sympathize with him and comfort him. Verse 12, when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. You can only imagine what Job looked like. I've told you before how painful boils are. Or, you know, if you're Mia, she's fond of the word. It was actually Deidre. Deidre likes the word carbuncle for some strange reason. But carbuncles are boils, and he had them from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. You can imagine not only the disfiguring ability of these massive pimple-like things all over his body, you can imagine the pain and how that would have distorted his face as well. They looked at him from a distance, and they couldn't believe what they were seeing. You know, I guess the last time any of them had seen Job, he was probably very well outfitted. He was probably very regal in his appearance. He was very composed. And now he's sitting on an ash heap in sackcloth, oozing from these boils. And what was their response? Well, they didn't recognize him. All they could do was raise their voices and wail. They wept in sympathy for him. As one commentator captured the scene, he says, approaching Job's dwelling, the three friends look eagerly from their camels and at length perceive one prostrate, disfigured, lying on the heap, a miserable wreck of manhood. That is not our friend, they say to each other. Again and yet again, this is not he. This surely cannot be he. Yet nowhere else than in the place of the forsaken do they find their noble friend, the brave, bright chief they knew, so stately in his bearing, so abundant and honorable, how he had fallen. It would have been quite the shock. And because they couldn't even recognize him, Job's friends not only raised their voices and wept, but we're told that they tore their robes. We've talked about that. It was a sign of mourning. They tore their robes, and then they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. What does that mean? We really don't know. It's just another sign of grief. It's just another expression of grief. Now, there's something really important here that we can learn that I fear is really woefully absent in many friendships today. Let me just ask you, do you have friends like this? Absolutely. And what a blessing that is. Better question would be, are you a friend like this? In Romans 12:15, the Apostle Paul instructs us to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Do you actually practice this kind of sympathy with others? When tragic news is shared throughout the body, do you react viscerally to that? When people are suffering, do you feel their suffering? Do you sympathize with their suffering? I mean, the same thing's true about rejoicing, but it's a lot more, it's a lot easier to rejoice when people rejoice, right? It's a lot easier to be happy than it is to join in the sadness of others. But the point remains the same. God calls us to be those who rejoice and weep with one another when it's appropriate. Are you that kind of friend? Are you willing to go out of your way to come alongside those who are hurting, those who are suffering loss, those whose lives have been interrupted with dark providence and tragedy? Or are you so preoccupied with yourself and your own issues that you can't be bothered with anyone else's issues? And sadly, again, this is a problem even in the local church. Our brother David Leach has been in the hospital, and He's been in the hospital a few times in the last several months, and it's been reported back to me that when he's asked, who's been by to see you? You? A few others. This is a problem, is it not? Now I realize we're all working every day, all day, and we all have busy lives and things like that. But I think this should be a point of conviction for all of us. Are we really the type of friend who will go out of our way to make sure that those who are suffering don't suffer alone? Those who are hurting don't hurt alone. The kind of love that we're called to exhibit toward one another is a love that, again, according to 1 Corinthians 13:7, bears all things. And what's included in that? All things. We bear one another's burdens. Paul says that in Galatians 6:2. He says, we're to bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. Are you doing that? Or are people more or less out of sight, out of mind? Job's three friends came to help him bear his burden. They've come to help Job bear that burden. And how did they do that? Well, this is one of the most beautiful things about the assistance they gave him, at least for the first week of their being with him. Verse 13, they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Sometimes we can be hesitant to help others or to go and sit with them or to comfort them in their grief because we don't really know what to say. You ever been caught in that situation? I would go see them, but I really don't know what I have to offer. I don't know that I can offer anything. Well, listen, it might just be going and sitting. Just being there can be a great comfort to those who are grieving. Believe me, if they have something they need to talk about, they'll talk to you about it. But more often than not, all they want is some warm body that they know loves them to sit next to them and say nothing. One of my favorite bluegrass songs, right? You say it best when you say nothing at all. There's also something about this 7-day period that is both interesting and alarming. Normally, sitting with someone for this precise period of time meant that death was imminent or that they had already died. In this case, I'm sure Job's friends, seeing him from afar and then going to his side, once they looked at him, all they could do was sit vigil with him for this 7-day period because in their own estimation, he was as good as dead. I mean, I've suffered through one boil and you'd think I was dying at the time. Of course, I am a man. So, you know, the common cold is also a very challenging thing for me. But you get the idea. You're covered from head to toe in boils. You're disfigured horribly. You're wearing sackcloth. You're covered with muck and mire, and you're scraping these sores. Pus is running down your arms and your legs. I mean, it had to be right out of a horror movie. And so what would you conclude? This man's not long for the world. And so they're sitting vigil with him for this period of time. In Genesis 50, verse 10, we see an example of this. Remember when Joseph died, or Jacob died, I'm sorry. He and his household came to the threshing floor at Atad. And what did they do? They lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And he, Joseph, ordered 7 days mourning for his father. In Ecclesiastes 22:12, we read, 7 days do men mourn for him that is dead. Again, we can only assume that these three friends thought, we're too late. He's really gone off the deep end here. There's no bringing him back. And you can imagine, I mean, how they would have felt sitting there. We also are told that Job didn't say anything else either. I mean, I don't know if there was small talk going on. I really don't know if this is the author's way of saying that they sat in relative silence. I don't know, but the picture's not pretty. It's a very, very dire situation. Well, this brings us to chapter 3. And here in chapter 3, we begin to see some of the inevitable cracks in Job's armor. We find out, lo and behold, Job is human. How do we know? Because Job reacts in a way that's similar to the way you and I would probably react in similar circumstances. Verse 1. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those who curse it curse the day who are prepared to rouse Leviathan." Now, stop there. That's not really that hard to understand, is it? Job curses not only the day of his birth, he goes all the way back to the night of his conception. He says, "God, pray to God that that never would have happened. Not just my birth, but my being conceived." In a typical poetic fashion, Job personifies the night. He does that because he's wanting to call the night to bear witness to the tragedy of his birth. What he's thinking is, if I was brought into this world to suffer in this way, it's better that I'd never been born. If I was brought into the world to suffer this way and go out this way, it's better for me never to have been conceived. And I'm calling the night itself to witness to the tragedy of my own birth. That's pretty heavy stuff. His desire is that the day commemorating his birth would simply vanish from the calendar altogether. And if that's not possible, he insists, may the day when it does come around each year be a day of blackness, a day that God himself is not pleased to shed his light on. Verse 8 is both interesting and confusing, especially if you're familiar with the superstitions of Job's day. What is meant by rousing Leviathan? Well, first of all, what is Leviathan? Leviathan is, in many instances, a reference to the crocodile. In a lot of the ancient Egyptian writings of the day that were written in Hebrew, the same word used to describe one of their deities was the crocodile deity. I forget which one that was exactly, but the same word is the word that we've translated as Leviathan. Leviathan was also a reference to a dragon. In superstition, especially in Job's day, it was believed that the Leviathan was a dragon who would periodically swallow the sun and or the moon. Now, we now know this to be an eclipse. But back then, when an eclipse would take place, they imagined this dragon encircling the sun or the moon, depending on whether it was a solar or lunar eclipse, and they would envision this dragon circling it and his scales blotting out the light. So again, it was a very superstitious thing. This Leviathan, Job is praying for this Leviathan to do the same with the day of his birth. Blot it out. Make it so it never happened. Darken the day. And he's calling upon the magicians who possess the power to call on the dragon or Leviathan to assist in darkening this day. You talk about a pity party. This kind of tops them all, doesn't it? I mean, he goes on incessantly here. It's not enough to say, God cursed the day of my birth. God, I wish I was never born. He waxes eloquent about how badly he wants this day to be eradicated from existence. Just for the record, the Leviathan was not often known in this way beyond Job's day, because it wasn't long before through the knowledge gained by the Persians, who were great in the realm of mathematics, even in the realm of some of the other up-and-coming places in the region. Alexandria in Egypt would have been another place where they were able to determine in fairly short order that these were not dragon scales covering the sun and the moon. So this was kind of a well-known mythology during Job's day, but not so much that far beyond Job's day. Anyway, picking up at verse 9, Job continues his lament. Yep, that's right. He just pours it on. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. Let it not see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth? Come forth from the womb and expire. Why did the knees receive me, and why the breasts that I should suck? The reference to knees here is, there's one plausible understanding of this, and then there's another one that's pretty well known. The plausible explanation would be, there was a time when if a midwife was helping a woman give birth, if the baby lived through the birth, one of the things the midwife would do to assure the mom that this was a live birth, which was, you know, not rare, but it was sketchy back then, but they would take the baby and lay it on her knees so that she can then pick it up and nurse it immediately. If they didn't lay the baby on your knees, chances are the news wasn't so good, right? The best interpretation, though, is that the father would also be present at the birth, and they would take the baby and place the baby on the father's knees so that the father could give the initial blessing to the baby and to give thanksgiving to God for providing yet another surviving offspring in the family. And so again, either one of those things, I believe, would be acceptable by way of interpretation here. Verse 13, for now, or better then, right, I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. What is he talking about? He's talking about if I had died, if I had never been born or died at birth, I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded. I would not be as infants that never saw light. There the wicked cease from raging, and there the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Note here that Job is describing, I think really beautifully, the state of those in the afterlife. I think he's describing not heaven, because the concept of heaven was not yet fully developed in Job's day. They would have referred to it as Sheol, the place of the dead. They believe that when you died, and we've talked about this, this is exemplified most clearly in Abraham's bosom. Lazarus, the rich man and Lazarus. Lazarus is reclining in Abraham's bosom, while the rich man is across the gulf that is too wide to cross. And he's begging Lazarus to go and tell his brothers not to come where he is, but instead to go where Lazarus is. Donald Gray Barnhouse used to call that, you know, Sheol is one place. It's the abode of the dead. And your standard of living in Sheol was one of two possibilities. You were either where Lazarus was, or you were where the rich man was, in torment, thirsting, angry, bitter, resentful. Donald Gray Barnhouse, pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia back during the 50s, he referred to this as East Hell and West Hell. Make of that what you will, but it is believed to be the place where Jesus went down and set free those who were in Abraham's bosom, or announced his victory over sin, death, and the grave, and set free those in Abraham's bosom, right? I'm still foggy on a lot of that. Don't ask too many questions about that. I'm being honest. I really don't understand all there is to know about that. But what's really exciting to me about this passage is that, in my mind at least, this comforts me in knowing at least where Job believed, and I believe, you know, the author's writing under inspiration. It gives me great comfort to know that at least Job is telling us here that those who die unborn and those who die shortly after birth, where do they go? They go to where the kings are. They go to where there's great enjoyment. They go to where there's rest and peace. Is that a proof text for babies who are aborted, babies who die in infancy, going to heaven? I like to think that it is. If you really want an interesting work on this, John MacArthur wrote a great small book, and I wish I knew the name of it, Safe in the Arms of God, I believe it is. And it's really a reflection on several of Spurgeon's sermons relative to what he believed was the reality that those who die preborn or in infancy automatically find themselves in the presence of God. I like to think that. Do I have a whole lot to go on scripturally? No, not really. But MacArthur's done his homework. Get that book if you really want to know more about that. It was of great comfort to me when I read it years ago. Sorry, Tanya, to recommend yet another book, but it's what I do. Yeah, it's a little bitty book. Yeah, yeah. The overarching point, though, is that Job considers death to be preferable to the life that he was now living, and who wouldn't? I mean, things were really bad. In verses 20 through 26, Job wonders aloud, why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet, and I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. Job's suffering. He's suffering badly. In a momentary lapse of sanity and judgment, he's not afraid to question God's goodness and fairness. That's exactly what he's doing. Don't try to candy coat it. Don't, you know, I've told you before, I've warned you before against taking the characters in Scripture and making more of them than they actually are. Job was a living, breathing human specimen, a fellow image bearers of God, a bearer of God, whose righteousness was Christ's righteousness. He didn't possess a righteousness of his own. And we're seeing that on full display. You let your guard down for one moment, especially at the height of suffering, and there's no telling what will come out of your mouth. Right? I mean, my wife has had a couple of kids. I remember in the delivery room, things came out of her mouth. Sorry, Dana. She was very good. But I've heard stories. This is a better way of putting it. I've heard stories about some of the things women say when they're giving birth, and who can blame them? Right? Who can blame them? I mean, at the height of suffering, we are prone to say and do things that we wouldn't normally say and do. Right? Anyway, what was the worst that could happen to Job? Well, at this point, the worst thing that could happen to him would be the best thing that could happen to him. The worst thing that can happen to him would be to take his wife's advice and just curse God and die. He felt that downtrodden. He was suffering to that degree. What's especially noteworthy about Job's expression of his feelings here, even if to our sympathetic ears we can certainly understand what he must have been feeling, what's especially important to note is that Job is clearly sinning. There's no other way to say it. Listen to Albert Barnes here, because Barnes comments on this, and I think his comments are really helpful. He says, "Let us not make the expressions used by Job in this chapter our model in suffering. Let us not suppose that because he used such language that therefore we may also. Let us not infer that because they are found in the Bible that therefore they are right, or that because he was an unusually holy man that it would be proper for us to use the same language that he did. The fact that this book is a part of the inspired truth of Revelation does not make such language right. All that inspiration does in such a case is to secure an exact record of what was actually said. It does not of necessity sanction it any more than an accurate historian can be supposed to approve all that he records. There may be important reasons why it should be preserved, but he who makes the record is not answerable for the truth or propriety of what is recorded. The narrative is true. The sentiment may be false. The historian may state exactly what was said or done, but what was said or done may have violated every law of truth and justice. And unless the historian expresses some sentiment of approbation, he can in no sense be held answerable for it. So with the narratives in the Bible, where a sentiment of approbation and disapprobation is expressed, there the sacred writer is answerable before it. In other cases, he is answerable only for the correctness of the record. This view of the nature of inspiration will leave us at liberty freely to canvass the speeches made in the book of Job and make it more important that we compare the sentiments in those speeches with other parts of the Bible, that we may know what to approve and what was erroneous in Job or his friends." Just a fancy way of saying, look, whatever we're reading about Job's response here, this is not a model. We simply don't have the right, and we've talked about this recently in our studies of Romans 9, we have no right to lay the claim of unfairness at God's feet. We have no right to claim that God is being unjust in dealing with us. If we truly understand who we are outside of Christ and what we deserve everything that happened to Job and then some. We deserve death. And it's only by the grace of God that He preserves us. It's only by the grace of God that He allows us to continue going on day by day by day. And so I think we would do well to have a firm grasp on the fact that Job is just showing that he's human here. You know, he's showing that he too bleeds red blood. He too experiences all kinds of pain and suffering. And he too has a breaking point. This reminds me, and should remind you as well, of the grace of God. Though He take you to that breaking point, He'll not leave you there. Job's going to be a shining example of that. Job is a shining example of how even when we fail God, He's faithful to us. Even when we act inappropriately toward God, God is always faithful to us. I hope you understand that. Lord willing, in our next study, we're going to see Eliphaz's very intense but yet practical response to Job. So if you're wanting to read ahead, please do that. Come next Wednesday and we'll talk more about these things.